Hello, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Patty, how's it hanging?
We're doing good today.
All right. So if you are one of our subscribers, thank you very much. If you're not a subscriber, please consider clicking the subscribe button that's down below. Also in the description, wherever you are obtaining this podcast from, you will find our link tree with links to our Facebook groups, email address, and everything paranormalist related. And with that, I think I've said all my things, even though I've tried multiple times and there's a bunch of things for the blooper reel. But with that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Patty and be surprised with what we're going to hear today.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Stu really doesn't have the faintest clue ever. I literally pull it out of the air, make it, do the research, and then he finds out when you all do. So today we are going to talk about ultra-terrestrial Bigfoot.
Ultra-terrestrial. Right.
Ultra-terrestrial Bigfoot. So I want to go back and give a little bit of information so folks will have some perspective. Bigfoot is not a new phenomena. You can go back, I would tell you, to the 1700s, and there are written reports in newspapers. But you can go all the way back to 986 AD. Leif Erikson and his men, when they found the New World, the Norsemen, they reported a creature, and I'm going to quote, okay, the huge hairy men that lived in the woods and had a rank odor and a deafening shriek. Now, it should be noted that he described them as beasts that were loud, foul-smelling. They called the creature the Skelring, S-K-E-L-L-R-I-N-G, Skelring. And that is what we now today know as Bigfoot. So they have been around a long time. The Skelring is a word that shows contempt. It roughly means a barbarian. And he was very adamant about how important, how full of hair these creatures were. He didn't say we met local natives and they were large and they had long hair. He said they were furry, hairy all over. So that's the most possibly the first recorded account of Bigfoot in the New World. So for hundreds of years, people have had these encounters with these monsters. They call them, you know, fairies, demons, cryptids, whatever they are. But what I have found interesting, we've talked slightly about this before, is that people, now that they're using psychedelics, are finding that they're meeting these creatures in other realms, spiritually speaking. So there are, and we'll go into that someday. We'll go into a whole episode on the fact that from the beginning of time of people using hallucinogenics, there are reports. And some of the things that I find fascinating about them are, suppose there's four people in a room. They all use the same hallucinogenic and they all are sitting there tripping out, right?
Right.
And when they come back and they're calmed down and they start talking, they realize they all had the same experience, met the same creature and had a similar conversation.
Interesting.
But it is interesting, and it makes you wonder if the old Native American beliefs that you could go from dimension to dimension by the use of altering your mind might not be true. Now, I called it an ultra-terrestrial, and I got that term from John Keel, famous for the Mothman prophecies, who was talking about all of these creatures, and he believed that Bigfoot's are not difficult to find because they're good at hiding. They're difficult to find because they can slip in and out of our physical universe into someplace else. Not only that, but that these creatures can make themselves invisible.
I'm processing that for just a minute because, I mean, it does, all the other stories that you've relayed before about them, especially like, you know, being seen near UFO encounters or UFO things and, you know, balls of light and things moving around with them. I guess invisibility doesn't surprise me either.
Yeah. And you know, you do hear the stories about the orbs, the mysterious lights in the sky and strange voices, but you don't hear this stuff on the TV shows. And the reason you don't hear this stuff on the TV shows is that there are investigators who have invested their reputations and a lot of money and time in proving that there is a bipedal creature, hominid, in North America and around the world, because now there's sightings all over the world, that is simply an undiscovered species of some sort. But the fact of the matter is, there are stories and have always been stories. They're being hushed up, quietly written about. They're not the stories that get featured on the TV shows. Yeah, they get into some of the books and podcasts like this. And it's because scientists don't want to tack their name to something like Invisible Bigfoots. But they will tack their name to, oh, we've got hair and DNA evidence from a Bigfoot on nails that we put through a board in front of a cabin where they supposedly were being, materializing or being, coming there. But that both things can be true at the same time. So when they physically materialize, they're able to be harmed. So they can step on a board with nails run through it to slow it down. But there are a lot of stories that they are not talking about other things. And today I wanted to take a look at some of the other things. So let's talk about some of the theories. Bigfoot's not a terrestrial animal. He's an alien being. That is something you'll hear quite a lot. And it's a lot of times it's because of the association with the UFO ships, aliens being seen in an area, mysterious light forms, things like that. So that's a theory. Now, I want to say that as we go into this part, I think multiple things can all be true at the same time. So I don't, there are different types of Bigfoot. There's the skunk ape. There's the albatross. There's all these different types and forms. There's 3 toes, 4 toes, 5 toes. There's 9 foot tall ones. There's 3 foot tall ones. So maybe we are seeing either some different things going on at the same time. Maybe there is a bipedal hominid, but maybe it's just different forms of the same thing. Maybe it shapeshifts. I'm not sure. So, but I do know that there are some really interesting stories, and we're going to get into some of those today. So we see a lot, like I said, of the light beams, portals, UFOs, those sort of things around them. So the next question is, if they come and go through portals or beams of light that beam them up, Scotty, or whatever, what happens if a human being is drugged into that? Do they go? Is that one of the reasons people disappear?
Well, you've covered so many ways that people can disappear. I mean, why not?
Exactly. I mean, that's the truth. I don't think there's always going to just be one answer for things. Another thing you hear about Bigfoot is that suddenly the Bigfoot was there and the forest fell silent. To me, that tells me that's something that's not normal. That's something that they're not used to. That's an intrusion. I've lived in the woods most of my life. And let me tell you, if I as a human being go clunking through the woods, animals will startle, but they'll still be there. They'll make noises. The birds will continue to fly. The turkeys will continue to run. The deer will, and snort. And maybe they'll take off a little ways and look at me, but they don't fall silent. They don't all stop doing everything they do. And I'm not supposed to be there. I mean, technically, I'm intruding into their domain, but they're not afraid of me, not in that way. But you hear that all the time. And it's really interesting. But not only that, you hear these other stories that are not talked about. And there's a book called Where the Footprints End, and there's volumes 1 and 2 of this. And in this book, Cutchin and Renner, they're the two gentlemen who wrote the book, talk about the wilderness geist, a woods spirit, based on the German words for Polten, meaning knock, and geist, spirit. One of the attributes of Bigfoot is it's a wood knocker. Like we've all seen all the Bigfoot teams on TV getting a piece of wood and whack, whack, whack. And then in the distance, you hear them whack, whack, whacking back. So it's a wood knocker. But what if it's a poltergeist of some sort, or it has the capacity to be? Nothing happens. You don't hear stories about, I saw the Bigfoot. There's maybe a handful I can think of. I saw the Bigfoot and it was throwing rocks at me. You hear stories that go like this. We were in the cabin, and suddenly the rocks began to rain down. When we looked out there, we saw nothing, but we heard the sounds, the screams. It had to be a Bigfoot. And that's a realistic interpretation. Or we saw shadows moving. It had to be, they were 9 foot tall. It had to be a Bigfoot. But if you look at a lot of the phenomena that happens around the Bigfoot sightings, it's poltergeist phenomena. Knocking, thumping, pounding, yelling, things appearing out of nowhere, things smashing walls, and you go out, and we're going to talk about a story in particular where that sort of activity happened. So maybe there is some sort of spiritual energy or some sort of energy form that can materialize. And we're going to talk about some of that. Ed and Lorraine Warren, and for those who don't know, were pretty much the some of the godparents, the early forerunners in the paranormal field, actually tried to work a Bigfoot case in Tennessee. When they got there, Lorraine, who claimed to be telepathic, contacted the creature, and she said to Ed, "We can't deal with this because it's not a physical being." She said, "It's a tulpa, a mind projection." She said, "So are the Loch Ness Monster and so many other creatures that get reported in the press." Now, for those who don't know, a tulpa is a thought that you think about strongly enough or often enough or so many people concentrate on that you make it materialize into existence. It's a thought form that takes on a physical shape and steps out of thought into reality. That's what she said it was.
Yeah, if you think about the, it was a piece of fiction, but the movie Forbidden Planet, where they, that was in the 50s, a very young Leslie Nielsen goes to this Forbidden Planet. There's a professor there that lives there with his daughter, and he made Robbie the Robot. That's where that became familiar. But he found on this planet things that the ancient aliens left there, and they left a thought amplifying machine. And just his very thoughts when he was asleep generated this huge creature which would smash things and, attack the ship and everything like that. Right. It was a machine that actually made the physical manifestation. But I'm wondering if whoever wrote that didn't have the same thing in mind.
Yeah. So our next one is that these Bigfoots, again, often seen in conjunction with or in the same vicinity as UFO sightings. You'll have a UFO sighting and then somebody will say, I saw a Bigfoot. We're going to talk about a couple of those stories. But there are people who believe that these are interdimensional beings that are servants or slaves of higher races and that their job on Earth is being sent to collect things and people.
Okay. A very interesting thought.
Yeah. Yep. They are servants of higher races that they tell them go out and collect humans and go collect other things, whether it's animals or, things from the forest or whatever it is. And again, that's another possibility as to one of the things that might be happening with all these humans disappearing. There are literally hundreds of thousands of people every year who disappear, millions actually, throughout the world. And that might be one of the many answers. Now, the last one, I'm gonna add it because it is fascinating. I have very little evidence for it, but it is being floated out there and has been for about 5 years now, that Bigfoots are actually the spirit, the ghost of Neanderthal man and or an elemental creature.
Those are completely different things, but
I know. But they tie the two together. It's one or the other, they think. It's one of the other two, one of the same things. But anyway, yeah, seriously. So there's a lot of things out there not being talked about. So we've gotten through, I know there are physical evidence, there's hair, there's footprints, there's scat. I get all that. And over the course of the years, there's credible sightings in the 1970s in Pennsylvania and Maryland. It's like right on the border. And these sightings and also came from, they were from a school teacher and a group of kids who were out hiking. And they saw a Bigfoot. They heard the sounds. They collected hair samples, footprints, and what have you. He actually sent this stuff to a DNA lab that came back and said, humanoid bipedal, species unknown. And we have multiple reports of this where people have sent, and even though our genetic ability to tell genetically what something is has gotten much better since the 70s to now, we still get the same simple answer. Species unknown. Humanoid, but species unknown. So what if it is, a creature that comes into our existence? What if it is an elemental that manifests itself and then fades away? But while it's manifesting, it's physical in nature.
I'd have to say my favorite theory out of them all is the alien. But then also when you describe so many different types. Mm-hmm. So think about how many different types of dogs there are. And we use the term dog. That could mean anything from a mastiff, pretty big dog, all the way down to a chihuahua. We still use dog. So why couldn't there be different sizes and types of Bigfoot? Why not?
Sure. If you look at the sightings, you will find that they vary immensely. The color, the size, the cognitive abilities are, they vary in so many ways. Let's talk about a couple cases. So this is a case of the fuzzy man in California at a state park. So there was a boy who disappeared in California in a state park, and he was later found 2 weeks later, unharmed and in really good condition. So now this is a child out in a state park on his own. He was about 9 years old. And when he was questioned after he was found, he said that the fuzzy man had taken him. And that the fuzzy man was the one who took care of him. And then the fuzzy man brought him back. He couldn't explain where he had been. He couldn't explain what had happened. All he would tell them is the fuzzy man. And here's the other interesting point. Where he was found, and you'll see this a lot in the 411 cases as well. There are cases where people are looked for in a certain area. There's search teams going out, professional search teams. I'm not talking a bunch of people just beating the woods. I'm talking people from that are specially trained for this, search and rescue people, who will go through an area and they'll go through that area multiple times and then come back and find either items from that person or that person or that person's body laying in plain sight where they've already searched a day or two earlier. And sometimes where they had actually walked that very day. There's a case in particular I'm thinking of where the rangers were going up and then the searchers, search and rescue were going up through a trail. And they had to walk along this trail to get to the search area. And every morning they would hike up this trail to the search area and then begin the search again. And they stepped over that area, walked over that whole trail, and then a few hours later, somebody else came to join them and found the child sitting on right in the middle of the trail. Hmm. And then I asked them about him. The child was like, I was just sitting here. I don't know how I got here. There's other cases. There's a story about a family that was out picking berries in the forest. They had two little boys. Both of them were under the age of 5. And at some point in the day, one of the boys disappeared. Of course, the family's frantic. They call for help because, there's a limited time window on all of this. So how fast can you find this child? They are looking for them. The search goes on for almost 2 months. And eventually, they finally have to admit they're not going to find the boy. So 6 months later, the family goes back to the place to put flowers as a memorial for the child that they assume has died in the wilderness. They bring their other son, and while they're putting flowers, they lose sight of the kid for 3 seconds, and he vanishes in the same spot.
Oh, my.
So the search is absolutely used. It's like the largest in the history of the state. Hundreds of people volunteer, hundreds of search and rescue from around the country come out. What a tragic story, right? And they're looking. They go on for well over a week. They go miles in every direction. They do that shoulder to shoulder march that they do where, you know, you can only search as far as your hands will go. And then the next part, you have to be able to touch the other searchers in the team. So you're all literally shoulder to shoulder, step forward, looking for any kind of a clue. So after they call the search off, the family is obviously devastated. 2 weeks later, a volunteer goes up in there and decides to just take a look and see what he can do. And 15 miles from the search site, he finds the kid. He's thought he would be dead, but he was not only alive, he was in good shape. They recover the child, and his clothes are clean. There's no dirt. He doesn't appear traumatized. The volunteer sat with the kid on a log playing with a twig bundle that was bound together with some old rope. And it was a female volunteer, and she's sitting there. She had radioed in, and she's waiting for people to come. And she says to him, "Where have you been? And who have you been with for the past 2 weeks?" And the kid says, "The fuzzy man." So she gets excited. She's thinking, okay, this is awesome. Bigfoot. Yeah, you know, she's the person that believed in it. She had heard a lot of the stories. And then she says to him, "Was he hairy?" And he says, no, he's not hairy. He's fuzzy. And she said, "What do you mean fuzzy? You know, like whenever you look through plastic wrap or something, he's all fuzzy. He's blurry. When your eyes are like almost closed, but not all the way." And he comes up out of the trees and he takes you into the woods. The kid said he was sleeping in a hollow tree. The fuzzy man gave him berries to eat. And she asked him, "Was the man mean?" And he said, "Oh, no, he wasn't scary. I didn't like that he didn't have eyes, though."
I'd call that scary, but, you know.
Yep.
So this was the second yeah. child, right? So the first one was.
Right. Mm. We don't know what happened. So anyhow, they take this child back to the police station. You know, the police officers interview him. They physically go over. He's in absolutely phenomenal condition. Literally, as though his mother had been taking care of him. Like I said, clothes are clean. He's neat. He's well fed. He's well kept. He tells the same story. And he talks to the police officers and he says he was allowed to wander around the clearing where the fuzzy man lived. But he couldn't go any farther or the fuzzy man would get mad and yell real loud, even though he doesn't have a mouth. And he said, "When I got scared at night, the fuzzy man would make it get brighter. And then he gave me my bundle, the twigs he was playing with, to keep him company." And he said the fuzzy man was going to keep him, but he let him go because the kid wasn't the right kind. So he told the boy he was taking him back. And when the boy said why, he said to him, "You're just not the right kind." He didn't know what that meant.
Do you?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
It could be any of 100 things I can think of: DNA, racial, age, sex. You know, there's a lot of things that could make you not the right kind.
Does that mean that the first boy was the right kind?
I don't know. I don't know if he's the same thing that happened to the first boy, but It's an interesting story, and it's eyewitness corroboration, which is rare, because usually those who return are either, there's one of three things that happen to them. They're either too small to talk, they're too old or mentally handicapped, or they don't have any memories. They can't tell you anything. It's like they've been in a daze. But this child could answer questions, and he consistently gave the same answers about the fuzzy man with no eyes and no mouth. Who talked? Did he talk in his head?
How else? Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is the story from Missing 411 of Dennis Martin, who was a little boy who was out vacationing with his family. He's running up the trail. His family's parents are there and they're walking. And I'm just giving a thumbnail. I'm not being detailed. But the point of the story is, like, literally he runs up around the curve of the trail. Nobody comes past them. And when they get up there, he's not there. His mom and his grandma, I believe, were up at the other end of the trailhead. Nobody had passed them going in. And nobody had passed his grandfather and his dad going out. So there's no clue where he went. So whenever this, you know, they realize right away that he's a missing child, they are panicked, they call for the park rangers, and at that point in time, it begins to get spread around. The park rangers are driving all over. They're looking, you know, madly for some guy who might have stole a child. Did anybody else see anything? So they're pulling into all the different camping sites and talking to people. A couple miles away, about a mile away as the crow flies, they find a family camping, having lunch, and it would have been line of sight right across from where Dennis disappeared. And they, you know, they talked to them a little bit, and that the guy was like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. But then it dawns on him. He says, hey, a little bit ago, we saw what we thought was a man in a fur coat carrying a bundle over his shoulder, but it was so far in the distance, we couldn't make out any detail. I don't know if that means anything or not, and I don't want to send you out on a red herring, but that's the only thing we saw. A man in a fur coat in the middle of the summer, walking up a trail with a struggling bundle. It's interesting. So, you know, those are stories of possible abductions by a Bigfoot. There's another one from Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio, in 1973, where a couple of family, it was a woman and her daughter, were awakened in the middle of the night by a light extending down out of the sky. So they're sleeping in their house. They're woke up with this bright light, and they go to the window and they look. So they walk, they're looking at this thing, and they're looking out the window, and they see what they call a grayish simian creature wandering toward the beam. Both the beam, the ape-like creature gets into the beam of light, stands in the middle of the beam of light. And then suddenly the creature and the light burst, just disappear.
Popping like a soap bubble.
That's exactly. For those who haven't heard the story, in the early 1970s, 1972, 73, 74, in Pennsylvania, there were a huge amount of bizarre Bigfoot sightings. And one of the stories that was told over and over again is seeing a Bigfoot walking through the woods or outside your home. And it was carrying a little glowing orb that was moving or was pinkish in color. Different ones described it slightly differently. But when it saw you or you caught its attention or you tried to shoot at it or anything like that, it popped like a soap bubble and just was gone. Isn't that bizarre? So now we're going to talk about a couple that were in a house, in a trailer, sleeping in a house trailer. And this was on October the 21st, 2:30 in the morning. The mom gets up. She's looking out the window while she's getting a drink of water, and she sees what she describes as a light going a cone of light perpendicular, like a huge bubble umbrella. And again, a creature steps into this light. She says it had an angled snout, no neck, and a sizable waist. Whatever it was there for about 5 minutes, and then suddenly both things just disappeared. They were connected in some way. In October of 1973, this is my favorite one because I actually am good friends with the gentleman who investigated it, Stan Gordon. So I've gotten firsthand, you know, stories from Stan about this. There were a group of farmers in Fayette County, Pennsylvania, who actually were Amish, and they saw a domed-shaped UFO about 100 feet in diameter. And they went to the neighbor's house, and they were like, you know, can we use your phone? We got to call the police, blah, blah, blah. So the neighbor's adult son came over along with a couple of other neighbors, and the upshot of the whole thing is that they all witness a pair of huge creatures covered in black, matted fur with luminous green eyes and long arms that dangled below their knees. The farmer's son, he was a teenager, shot at the creatures, one of which raised its right hand in the air. And at that moment, the UFO above them disappeared. The two Bigfoots escaped into the woods and were not seen again. Interestingly enough, there was a lot more to it. There was a Bigfoot was seen trying to steal a chicken out of the barnyard. There were investigators who came, like I said, Stan Gordon and his team. One of them got deathly sick. At one point, the state, and they were called by the state police who went in to investigate. There was an invisible barrier about the size of the 100-foot craft where you could walk up to this area and then you couldn't go through it. You would slide around it. And when you did, you recognized that it was a large oval area that looked perfectly normal, but it was something invisible was sitting there. So, you know, that's when the police were like, hey, we're calling somebody else. And somebody's like, well, hey, there's this guy, you know, who's looking for this stuff.
That's out of our jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's definitely not in our playbook, man. So we'll talk about a farmer in Wisconsin by the name of William Bozick. And he was at a co-op meeting on December the 9th of 1974 when he was nearly slammed into a globular UFO on the road in front of him. Its bottom half enshrouded in fog. The invisible transparent dome inside of it, he could see a 6-foot tall ape-like creature with reddish brown fur covering the body except the face and distinctively pointed ears. It appeared to be operating a control panel. As he drove past it, scratching up his car because he grazed it, that's what got the attention because there shouldn't have been anything there. You couldn't see anything. It rose and he saw it for a few seconds and that's how he could describe it. And then it disappeared. In Rutland, in British Columbia in 1976, several people, several men and their children saw a hairy bipedal creature, 6 to 7 feet tall, roaming around the mountainside. They found clumps of hair that was sent to the Royal Mounted Canadian Mounted Police for identification. The laboratory confirmed it was primate hair, but they couldn't match it to any primate on Earth. That is absolutely fascinating. So you have that connection between the UFOs and the alien, these entities, whatever they are. So now let's talk a little bit about invisibility, invisible Bigfoots. So we saw that the craft were invisible. We know that they can pop like soap bubbles. They can blink out of when the UFO disappears. One of the stories that I came across was a really interesting one from August of this year is when it was published. Now, when it happened, I can't tell you for sure. The person who wrote this, the magazine that published it, didn't give that data. There are a lot of stories about cloaked figures. And by cloaked, I mean sort of like what you saw in Predator, where you could see a shape, the essence of what it was, but you couldn't see it. You could see the best description I've ever heard is like looking through saran wrap and it's all kind of wavy, but you could see a shape. Supposedly this gentleman was at his property. The dogs were going crazy and he was looking outside to see what was going on. And that's when he saw what he described as a thing that looked like a human face peering through the foliage. And he had a camera on it because he had his cell phone up. Everybody today has a cell phone. You know, when they have those ring cameras and all that stuff outside. And so he's taking pictures and he sees what looks like a distinct human face or distinctly humanoid face, I should say. And it's looking at him, but it has the texture of bark. And it was camouflaged, like it was hiding in the trees or it was a trick of the shadows or something. He actually got video of it, which you can actually download and play if you're interested in seeing what it looks like. Now, is it just his eyes playing tricks in a, you know, light and shadow dancing? I don't know. But he was pretty shaken by it. There are a lot of these stories, these kinds of stories, and they're called Glimmerman stories because they're translucent in appearance. And it's beginning to be talked about that possibly these are cloaking devices. So that they aren't caught, they aren't shot. So what if these things materialize, and when they do materialize, we've heard this about other entities, that when we talked about that with the not deer, when they are manifesting physically, they're vulnerable to a bullet or a knife or whatever. So they cloak themselves so they can't be shot at, so they can pass unimpeded through areas for whatever the reason. It's kind of hard to argue, fight with something you can't see. Suddenly it was just there, and then for a second, and then it was gone. I came across a story in Kentucky about a gentleman who bought some land and was building a cabin, and he shares his story online, and he talks about how, you know, it was a really beautiful property. This was kind of like his dream place, and he has a couple dogs, and he would go out and work on the place and his time off, and the dogs were never yappy, whiny, difficult to deal with. And so he was really shocked whenever they would get out there to this little property and they didn't want to go outside. Like, it got to the point where when he put them in the car, they would try to not get in the car. They didn't want to go. And when he got him to the cabin as he's working on the interior of it, and he went to put him outside, they wouldn't go outside. He'd have to shove them outside, go out with them, wait 5 or 10 minutes, and then they would be running for the door as fast as they could. They didn't want whatever was going on out there, they weren't interested in. And he said, at first he sort of just shrugged it off, like, you know, I'm not sure what's going on with them. But then he said after he'd been there about 6 months, he began to experience poltergeist activity. He has security cameras that he has installed and lights in the woods along the perimeter. And he says he never sees anything come out of the woods. And there's never anything that goes into the woods. And yet, he'll hear somebody out there. He'll hear walking. He'll hear pounding. Things will get moved. And it sounds like something's beating on the walls, but he doesn't see anything at all. The dogs react every time. And he said the cameras pick up a lot of strange stuff, shadows cast on buildings, but no person to attach to the shadow. A wooden fence that collapsed, not because it was badly built, but because all the nails in the wood were suddenly broken, cut in two. He said every night around 2 o'clock in the morning, he loses power, despite the fact he has a powerful solar backup. He hears sounds, screaming, pounding. And he says, the thing is, when it starts, everything else is quiet. There's no tree fogs. There's no night birds. There's no anything. And all the animals leave the property, like the wildlife. All just go. They don't want any part of whatever it is that's happening. He doesn't have an answer. He only knows that something's going on out there. He's hearing the sounds. He's, you know, these are things. You hear footsteps. Something's pounding hard on the side of the structure. But when he looks, there's nothing there. When he physically looks, when he looks at the camera feeds, there's nothing there. Now, this is not new, believe it or not. This has been reported for a long time, just not talked about. Like I said, the media won't cover it as a rule. And certainly the Bigfoot community is antsy about this whole thing because they don't want to be accused of believing in ghosts and interdimensional beings and yada, yada. So in 1977, there was a case that is really interesting. This took place in North Dakota. There was a Bigfoot-type creature spotted throughout the afternoon and into the evening. Locals, along with the police, staked out the area and searched for this creature. A rancher by the name of Lyle Maxson reportedly had a strange encounter, claiming he was walking in the dark when he heard something nearby breathing heavily as if it was running. So he shone a flashlight in the direction of the sounds. And that's a very distinctive sound that, you know, you recognize it right away. And puzzled that he could hear it, but he could see nothing where the sound was coming from. It was disturbing. He kept walking. He could hear it huffing as it was keeping pace with him. And he could hear the steps, but he couldn't see anything to the eye. And it frightened him very badly. Now, this is in conjunction with UFO sightings and conjunction with Bigfoot sightings in the area. But it's a Bigfoot if it is a Bigfoot. And that's an if. If it is a Bigfoot, it's a Bigfoot that's completely invisible. And it was stalking him, following him.
Maybe he wasn't the right type.
Maybe he wasn't. I have to say that I found it fascinating. So I found a really interesting story. This is an old story that goes back, way back. So those who don't know, Livermore, California is home of the Livermore National Laboratory. And it's been there since 1952. In 1981, it became a federal, it was federally funded research and development center aimed at multidisciplines of research for national security, solving ways to deal with issues and threats to energy, environmental security, and other classified projects. And when the government's involved, God only knows what that means. Seriously. I know they did look into nuclear weapons, plutonium, radiation, a lot of other stuff. The 7,000 acre experimental test site. It is huge. Now, I will say, I am personally do not believe that the government is trustworthy in any way, size, shape, or form. That is my private opinion, and I'm allowed to have it, at least for now. But the person who reported this is the reason that this story is really significant to me. Okay? Lauren Coleman has been in the crypto field for a long, long time. He is one of the godfathers of the crypto field. He is one of the smartest men I've ever met. He is a gentleman to the core. He is a very detailed researcher, and this story came up in his site called Cryptomundo. Now, I'm not saying he says it's true. I'm not saying he says it's not true. He reported it. That is all I am saying. But the fact of the matter is, having talked to Lauren and read his work over the years, I know that if he didn't think that this was worth at least a look-see, he wouldn't have put it out there, okay? So there have been stories that the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, they had held a Bigfoot in captivity in the 1960s and early 70s, maybe more than one. So the story goes that they had managed to capture a Bigfoot, and that they had taken it to this facility and they were studying it. But the Bigfoot managed to breach security and escape and was inside the complex building running amok. It was invisible. That's why they couldn't see it to catch it. But the women who worked there, the secretaries and what have you, were empathic enough, several of them, that they would say, oh, it's in that direction. Or they would see physical evidence of it having passed by, things bumped out of place, things moving. You would hear the sound of it running, but it was invisible. At one point, it was seen when it was in its physical state and turned invisible as it ran past a janitor. After he had opened the door thinking the room was empty, because they were told they had to keep all the doors shut until they caught this thing. It is believed that it travels in the fourth dimension, that it is able to be invisible and pass through objects at will. And it was trying and attempting to exit somehow. Now, how it didn't work, I don't know. Now, here's the interesting thing. This was in the building at large for several weeks, and there was a huge panic. People were frightened of it. You know, there were times it would materialize and they would see it, and there were other times whenever you would be smashed into by it or what have you, because it was moving through the area or you walked into it. And they said they caught the animal and that they continued their research on it. The gentleman who did the report was asked how he gave the report to Cryptomundo, was asked how he knew about this. And his response was, it was well known at the time in the UC Berkeley area. He said, I believe Stephen Hawking participated to some degree in the latter studies in the 74 and 75. The scientists continued to study the Bigfoot while it was at large. They did so by standing in front of its travel path and letting it walk through them. They were able to determine it held no ill will toward the captors, but only wanted to get out of the building. And then he talked about the fact that he had spoken with people through that in the area who were in the science community that he knew, who had all heard the story and or knew parts of it. It was one of those open secrets, if you will, that they talked amongst themselves about. And he also said that he had, that they had caught other ones over time and took them to the same laboratory. He talked about another one that had gotten out, made messes, got into the break room, ate food at night, and tore the place apart in that area. And so whatever it was, it needed sustenance of some sort. Now, that is in this guy's conclusion. He says that in 1979, there was a report that was sent out by the DOD from the laboratory. And he said there was a copy. There were copies of it. The government now denies that it existed. And he said, but I actually read one of them. And he said the one of the copies. And he said the conclusion of the DOD study was that the Bigfoot cannot be contained, controlled, or communicated with. And it is thought to be alien in origin. And he said, I believe they're wrong about the communication aspect, because anybody, almost anybody can communicate with a Bigfoot if you're given the proper instruction. At least that's my belief.
And if you go back to the story you've told before about Davy Crockett, you know, the Bigfoot told him, don't go there. You're going to die. Yeah.
And there are other stories where people have said that they talked to Bigfoots in their head, you know, things like that. So that's not an unusual thing. So now I want to talk about the last story for tonight. And it is the story of a gentleman by the name of Ron Moorhead. So I'm going to just kind of set the stage. Back in the 1970s, Ron Moorhead and three or four other friends of his, who were all hunters, were up in the Sierra Madre Mountains in California, and they were hunting. They had an area that they hunted all the time. A lot of hunters have a preferred territory they always hunt in. They know that area well. They have good luck in that area and what have you. So they would go up into these mountains, and they're beautiful, they're vast, and they're dangerous. And they would stay for a week at a time. So they found this one area, and they built a kind of rough shelter there with fallen logs that they wove in among walls of trees, and kind of created a structure that was very primitive. And they would go in there and sleep because it was safer, because there were a lot of dangerous animals up there. And there were also a lot of Bigfoot sightings. And at that time, they didn't really buy the Bigfoot story. But, you know, it's still safe if there's bear and there's mountain lions and what have you, to have a shelter around you when you're at your most vulnerable. And when you're sound asleep, you're pretty vulnerable. So anyway, they're up there one night, and this would have been about 1971, and it was him and three of his other friends. They're camping, and they're in this rough shelter, and in the middle of the night, they hear pounding, and they hear thumping, and they hear what sounds like the great big wash tubs they had brought along to do the dishes. You know, they're like they're being smashed against the ground, and all this screaming and what have you. They expected the whole area to be torn up in the morning, but they sat quietly inside the shelter, waiting it out, not knowing what it was. It didn't sound like a bear. It didn't sound like a mountain lion. And they were afraid, and there was no reason to go out there until daylight. So in daylight, they go out. Everything's pristine, just as they had left it the night before. But they heard clearly those sounds of it being torn to shreds. And they heard the pounding so hard at times that it rocked these great big pieces of log that were wedged between the trees to create the walls. And that starts this whole thing. What ends up happening is they are fascinated by what's going on, and they go up there multiple times throughout the years, and they have a lot of events. By 1974, so 3 years after they started this, they are now hearing these things happening all the time, but they've added another element to it. They hear screams, they hear hoots, and language, not English, nothing they recognize, but a rudimentary guttural language being spoken by multiples of these creatures. And they record it. And you can get online, and I can send you the link if you want, and we can post the link if you want, and you can hear it for yourself. They have actually, they sent copies of these recordings to sound engineers who said it's above and below human range of speech, that based upon the tones and the depth, it sounded like a very large creature, larger than a human, larger than a human for all of them. You know, there's like these really deep, and then there's high-pitched squeals. Whatever it is on the tape, it's intelligent. They mimic it, it mimics them back. And it's communicating whatever they are. And there's more than one. You can definitely tell there's more than one. You can hear multiple things making sound at the same time. And it's fascinating to hear. It's the best thing I've ever heard in that respect. Now, this is an area where Missing 411 has also designated that there are multiple people who have disappeared and never been found in this area. In fact, if you go to Missing 411, The Hunted, it is the last, no, the next to the last story in the documentary. He does interviews with Ron Moorhead and plays the data, the recordings and what have you. And among the stories that he tells, Mr. Moorhead, is he talks about the fact that they would see balls of light moving at night, floating in the sky, bouncing along above the tree line, lights shooting around that they couldn't explain. And he tells a really interesting story about one night he and his wife are up there and they're just kind of camping, you know, it's like social camping type thing. And it's dusk, but it's not completely dark. And they notice a 3-foot rod about 4 to 6 inches in width, 3 foot long. It's a rod of light. And it comes floating slowly out of the trees, appearing to have the ability to be controlled and capable of being moved. And it goes through the trees, along their line of sight, and then blinks off. And again, the lights in the sky, multiple times, large lights, small lights, little orbs of light, dancing and moving around, almost like foo light, if you will. And this happened for a long time. This was prior to the 3 disappearances that have since occurred on that spot, which is what brought David Politis to the area in the first place. And it was then that he heard the Bigfoot stories and the weird stories of the lights. And it's then that he reached out to Mr. Moorhead and said, tell me what your life experiences were there. And he said the whole time they were there, they never saw anything, ever. Even when they tried to see out to see what was pounding and tearing stuff up, you never saw a thing. You only heard it.
And way before the era of video recorders and things like that. So
it's a very compelling story. It really is. And for those who want to hear it, you can go to www.bigfootsounds.com, or you can check out the David Politis documentary, and that's Missing 411, The Hunted. And I recommend it. It's a great documentary. Watch the whole thing through. Don't just fast forward. It's great. And with that, I have laid out a case that that Bigfoot is a lot more mysterious than we think he is.
Yeah, evidently so. So as far as those links, I can link those down below in the description. You know, I don't want to put those in our link tree. I have to be very careful with our video platforms, that we don't have any copyrighted material within them, that we don't have licensed already. So, with that being said, though, so I mean, if it's something that I can try to embed, you know, and you've said it before, the vast majority of our subscribers listen through an audio platform.
Right.
So, but we still, I mean, if you're watching this through a video platform, we can try to put those links in there as well. Again, you know, copyright, you know.
And it's not hard to find them. If you put in Ron Moorhead, there's going to come something up on YouTube and it's going to be the sounds. I did it today just to see how easily it was done, and it was easily done. So if you're fascinated, I have to tell you, I turned the sound up. I sat there and I listened. I heard the obligatory normal, you know, screams and chatter that you would normally hear. I've listened to an awful lot of Bigfoot recordings over the years of my life, because I have a lot of friends who are in the Bigfoot community, okay? And I've been privileged to be allowed to do that. Plus, there's a lot of them now on YouTube. And this one has literal language. Like, you hear them talking in syllables, words, whatever those words are. They're not English. They're not anything I recognize. But they're definitely, they're speaking. And they're invisible.
Yeah, well, there's no way that you can convince me that our government, military, and others don't already have the ability to do cloaking like that. I mean, that just, there are so many YouTube videos that I've seen, war zones, where you just see that, like the shimmer, the heat shimmer moving, you know, and it's just, and again, in today's day and age, anything video can be manipulated. So don't believe anything you see. But also, you know, take it as evidence, too. I mean, look at it, you know, make up your own mind whether that can be real or manipulated.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to pull up old cases when in the 1970s, we weren't talking about this stuff, when there was no internet and none of the things were happening. So one of the problems with getting reports today of anything is that you can go online and you can look it up and then you can fake it. So easily. And I'm not saying that everybody that makes a report does that, but it's something that as an investigator, a researcher, you have to now factor in with everybody, no matter how sincere they sound. But in 1970, there was no internet. You couldn't look it up. There was maybe a couple books that talked about a mysterious hairy beast. You know, TV shows like In Search Of were just coming into their own. And even they didn't portray them this way. So to have people from across the country telling the same stories at the same time about something that wasn't being discovered and talked about in public, then they are eyewitnesses that are pretty compelling, because there's nothing, there's nowhere you can lead back to say, well, they saw that on YouTube. So I chose deliberately a lot of older cases because I wanted to say I felt they were more impressive because they predate internet and all of that. And they were published at the time. So it's not like somebody coming back years later and going, oh, yeah, I saw that. Yep. In 1972. These are stories that made the press at the time, or that they reported to people at the time, the police or what have you. So these were interesting and compelling stories for that reason as well. And they definitely do not paint the same picture of Bigfoot that we're taught when you watch the TV shows. They're not Milgram's Bigfoot, which is a, you know, physical bipedal hominid. Maybe he, and I don't believe that he's wrong. I mean, far be it from me to tell a man with his, you know, talent and intellect that he's wrong. I think they're both. I think they can be physical, and then they can somehow manipulate reality so they can not be physical anymore. And that explains why we don't catch them. That explains why we don't see them unless they let us. And it's for brief periods of time, because I think, like those not deer, when they're manifesting and they're physical on our realm, they're also vulnerable on our realm. And that impedes them in their work.
Whatever that may be.
Yeah. Whatever it may be, you know. But if you're not the right kind, you're not the right kind. It's fascinating, though, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, unless you have some more, I'd like to thank those who have stuck with us through this episode all the way to the very end. And we appreciate you clicking the like button down below if you can, or, you know, if you're listening on an audio platform, if you have the means to be able to like or give us a rating, that would be great as well.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Put a lot of hours in on this. Love it. It's a labor of love for both of us. And we hope that we entertain, we make you think, and just wonder a little bit more. But be careful when you don't see something, because that might be just as dangerous as when you do. Good night.
And I'm going to take a suggestion from one of our listeners and do this. There we go. If you are viewing this, you may